You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this official holiday season Monday. Work day, some kind of shopping online sale day. I lose track. We are on track, though, today. Following developments in Central Africa, we're looking back and forward in the law, the consequences of the three strikes criminal sentences that began in the 1990s, and a look forward to the consequences of growing anti-terrorism watch lists, more persistent, perhaps, than a bad credit score in terms of the effect on your life. We'll also talk about bad credit scores and car sales. But we begin, since this is a Monday.
It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. I'm feeling good.
Well, how good is the Obama administration feeling about the Affordable Care Act and that troublesome website, healthcare.gov, from a 40% functionality at launch today? It's up to 90%, according to officials at Health and Human Services. Healthcare.gov can reportedly now handle 800,000 users a day, but with Americans rushing to meet the December 23rd enrollment deadline, there is still a danger of crashes and overloads. Congresswoman Diana DeGette, Democrat representing Colorado's 1st District, joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome.
Good to be with you.
What are your chief concerns at this point? Are you satisfied with corrections made to the website, and what are your constituents telling you?
Well, at this point, it does look like they've made many, many improvements to the site, so that's good. I just went on it this morning before I got on the phone with you, and I noticed a substantial improvement in the speed and the access and all of that. The big concern right now seems to be the back end of the site. So after people sign up, getting that information to the insurance company so they actually know that they have these new customers. And that still seems to be slow. It looks like what the administration did was focus on getting access for consumers to the site and then figured that they would work on the other later. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but it's good news that at least people are able to get on and enroll.
So how worried are you that after people have a good experience being online and getting some of their questions answered, that they're not going to receive, you know, bad news later on when the insurance companies actually rule as to whether they're going to take these folks on and under what conditions, that sort of thing?
I don't think there's a question of will the insurance companies accept them, because, of course, under the Affordable Care Act, they can't reject them for pre-existing conditions or gender or things like that. But it's a matter of the insurance companies knowing that they have these consumers. So, for example, if January 1st came and they didn't know that somebody was enrolled in a plan and, heaven forbid, they had some kind of emergency and went to the emergency room, the insurance company needs to know that they have this person on their policy.
And what would ensure that that is the case? I mean, what does the administration need to do if I'm, you know, in the ambulance on the way to the hospital to get some assurance that, in fact, I'm covered?
The administration now needs to make sure that this back end is improved just as quickly as the front end appears to have been improved. So what they need to do now, and with rapid speed, is get all this information to the insurance company so they can issue cards for the people starting on January 1st. And that's the primary question I'm going to be asking this week.
Now, how much of this is a normal, you know, huge job of the federal government expected chaos, and how much of this is just a completely botched kind of messaging and strategy on the part of the administration that's frustrated you politically as much as you want to serve your constituents?
I think that the rollout of the website was incredibly botched. Everybody from the president on down agrees with that. People had thought that this website would be ready a lot sooner than it was, and that was not just politically problematic, but also, you know, we have millions of people who want to get on these exchanges and get insurance. So it was problematic for everybody. But, you know, these things can get fixed. I remind people, in 2006, when we started up the website for the Medicare Part D coverage, that thing crashed and it was down for 2 months. So technology can be fixed. What we need to do now is we need to let folks who need insurance know that they can go on to the site and they can enroll.
But isn't it more
and not to get discouraged?
But isn't it more important that people who don't think they need insurance need to go and have patience and deal with this? I mean, you've got in the middle of the holiday season, Jeff Bezos of Amazon talking about using drones to deliver packages. I mean, that's the highest of the highest tech. Young people are used to that kind of level of technological sophistication. There's the danger they've just given up and aren't coming back here.
Well, what was interesting, I think it's a little of both. What was interesting was when on October 1st, one of the reasons why the website crashed is because so many millions of Americans tried to go on there and see what they could get access to. So those people need to be brought back. But then you're right, there's a whole other group of people, and many of them are young people who need to be convinced to buy insurance. And there are programs, both the administration and also a number of nonprofit groups have started up education programs targeted at telling those folks they need to go get insurance.
You know, you've got constituents who probably are in all three of these categories. Why don't you rank the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, the rollout of the Xbox One, and the rollout of the Kindle? Over there at Amazon. Any interest in seeing those characters in the latter two rollouts move over to the government?
You know, we've had some very effective marketing campaigns going on here in Colorado. And Colorado, my state, is one of the states that has its own exchange. So while we've had our own unique set of problems here in Colorado with our exchange, we've had a lot of interest from folks in enrolling. But you know, the federal government is not Amazon. It's not a private entity, and there's positives and negatives in that. But I think one thing we can learn, and I hope the administration did learn from the rollout of this website, is we have very, very talented folks who can design these things, and we should be looking to them for successful rollouts.
Congresswoman DeGette, are you on board now with the Affordable Care Act, or do you expect to take some real heat in 2014 in your reelection?
Well, you know, I was always on board with the Affordable Care Act. I was one of the folks who helped write the act as a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. I think it's really important that we get health care for all Americans and for those 47 million who were uninsured, to help them get access either through the exchange or through private insurance companies or through their employers. That's very important. The botched rollout of the website really, really put a mar onto the whole Affordable Care Act. And I'm cautiously optimistic now. I'm worried about this back end. I'm worried that we need to now get the information to the insurance companies. I'm happy to defend the Affordable Care Act. I think it's sound, but it needs to be properly implemented.
Congresswoman Diana DeGette, thanks so much.
Great to be with you. Take care.
Congresswoman DeGette is Democrat representing Colorado's 1st District. Well, there's one Democrat's cautious view of where we are now on the Affordable Care Act. Let's turn now to Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So a lot of wisdom there. Government, not Amazon. We should add a government, not Zappos, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Diana DeGette is an important player in this. But let's keep one thing in mind about Ms. DeGette. She's not vulnerable. She's from the middle of Denver. She's safe. She has a high approval rating. And probably, regardless of the fate of Obamacare, Diana DeGette isn't going anywhere. And the question for Democrats in Washington isn't like people like DeGette. It's what about us? We're in vulnerable districts. We voted for this thing, and if it doesn't start working and it's not perceived as a success, we want to unhitch our wagon to this. They're wondering about that.
So remind me of who this fellow Jeff Zients is.
Well, Jeff Zients is the guy who the White House brought in to try and fix the botched website. He has been the healthcare.gov czar, if you will, my term, not theirs, for the last month. And Jeff Science was on a conference call. I think we have a cut of it.
Yeah, let's just hear to see. I mean, here he is talking about some of the problems, and I want to ask you when we hear this, if he's noticed any of these problems with the back-end issues that Congressman DeGette was already talking about. Listen.
The team identified the root cause problems that needed to be addressed to fix the site. These root causes included hundreds of software bugs, inadequate hardware and infrastructure, and a general lack of system monitoring and incident response capabilities. Our assessment also identified weaknesses in how the project was being managed, with slow decision-making and diffuse or unclear accountability.
Slow decision-making. That could apply to the back end. What do you think, Todd?
Oh, it applies up and down, and this idea of the back end is the most important part now. What they have done a pretty good job, we'll find out, but what the White House, the CMS, says they've done a good job of fixing is the user experience. You get through it faster. The website doesn't crash as much. It can handle 400,000 people a day. We'll see if that's actually true going forward. It appears to be working more smoothly. But that's only one small part of the picture. And we've talked about sort of the Rube Goldberg machine, the guts of healthcare.gov that really makes the policy go. Here's a bit of jargon for you. Insurers call them 834 forms. What is that? That's the ticket that goes from healthcare.gov to the insurer and sort of carries your information, if you're an Obamacare beneficiary, carries your information to the insurance company. What's your profile? What's your age? What do you qualify for? Do you qualify for subsidies? How much? How much did you make last year? All of these things, and you can see all the different bits of information that are important. And you heard Ms. DeGette talking about how a lot of insurance companies are saying that back end is still not fixed. We are getting calls from people who think they're enrolled and they're not. And if that part doesn't start working and working well, it spells trouble.
What kind of bad news is going to come out of it? I mean, in the first case scenario, the bad news was people were losing their plans. On this insurance back end issue, the bad news is you're in the hospital and you find out you're not covered or something like that.
And it's all important. And the politics of this looks at exactly both of those points and more, John. Here's what Republicans are poised to do going forward. Look, it's a website. Nobody thought the website would be broken forever. Who would ever think that? So now Republicans are prepared. You're going to hear them not talking about the website, but talking about all of the other inevitable experiences that some people are going to have as healthcare changes that are negative. I got a cancellation notice. My premiums went up. Or the insurance company didn't get my 834 form, even though a member of the public wouldn't know what that is. Now, there will always be some people with some complaints, and the question is, what is the overall experience? And after January 1st, here's the other question. Republicans aren't likely, John, to keep voting on repeal unless this entire thing is a disaster. And why? And this is one thing that members of Congress, Democrats, might take a little bit of faith in. After January 1st, people start getting benefits. And after then, a vote to repeal is a vote to take something away that somebody already has. And that's going to change the political dynamic between January 1st and the elections in 2014.
So how many shopping days until people actually start getting benefits? That's the real question. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and you can be a part of this conversation or any other. 877-8-MY-TAKE. So last week, a relatively obscure and localized dispute between China and Japan over a chain of islands in the East China Sea went global. China unexpectedly declared an air defense identification zone over the islands, technically compelling international aircraft to recognize their claim in choosing their routes through East Asia. The East China Sea, just south of the Sea of Japan, look at it on a map, the waters may be indistinguishable, but the politics couldn't be more different. Joining us to help us understand the significance of this is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine. He's reported on China and East Asia and Japan extensively. James Fallows, welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you again.
So the Israelis used to talk about, or observers of the Israelis in the West Bank and Gaza used to talk about the facts on the ground issue, where you would create settlements that create sort of territorial facts that would be difficult to negotiate later on. Is China adopting a policy of facts in the air to try to resolve this dispute or push it in their direction?
I think that would be the most sort of rational, that would attribute the most rational motives to what China has been doing, as opposed to thinking this was just a miscalculation or a gesture mainly to satisfy internal critics of the current administration. Because the idea from the Chinese point of view might be, if they set up this air defense in identification zone known as ADIZ in the business, over time they can get people to acknowledge its presence there, and this becomes one more exercise and demonstration of sovereignty, and they can say, well, look, we've always had this claim to these waters. They're not just Japan's and South Korea's, so let's talk about the other rights we also have.
What's the precedent for allowing civilian aircraft to honor such a designation, but violating it with military aircraft, as the U.S. seems to have done? And I can't quite decipher what's really happened over the last 7 days.
It's a fairly weird situation, because while technically there are precedents for setting up an ADIZ, there's none that's exactly like this one. For example, the U.S. has these ADIZ borders all around its coastlines, but in practical terms, almost nobody would ever cross into that ADIZ unless they're also coming into the United States. It just wouldn't make sense to be flying 3 miles offshore from the U.S. So it doesn't ever come up as an issue that you're going to have to be cleared in just to pass through the country. Also, the U.S. zones don't overlap with other country zones, whereas China's very intentionally goes right over the top of where Japan has set one up and a little edge of what South Korea has done. So I think the U.S. reaction in the very first day, which was to send a couple of B-52s just cruising through there with no advance warning, was a response to the oddity and the unilateral nature of this. For the airlines themselves, they're actually the least important players here, because they're used to filing flight plans wherever they go anyway.
And, you know, you're a pilot, and so you know of what you speak directly. Might the Chinese have a case to make about the way the U.S. handles the defense zone over Hawaii, for instance, as a possible precedent here?
Sure. And I guess an important difference would be that Hawaii, like some of the outlying, Hawaii is an extreme case of what China has in some of its outlying territories, especially the island of Hainan, where Hainan is not connected to the Chinese mainland, but everybody knows for sure it's part of Chinese territory. So too with Hawaii. It's, you know, thousands of miles from the rest of the United States. But as we've demonstrated from 1941 onward, it's viewed as an integral part of the U.S. landmass. There's not much dispute about whether things which are officially part of your territory are under your control for airspace and all the rest. The thing that's unusual, again, about this Chinese zone is it would be as if the U.S. set up a new zone in the Caribbean that would affect planes going from Mexico to Cuba, excuse me, or Venezuela or someplace like that, and weren't coming to the United States. So it's a geographical unfairness that affects China, that they are right next to all these other countries with a small amount of territory. And so the way they've placed it creates complications that are really almost impossible to arise in an American situation.
All right. So the geography here is unusual, and the way the Chinese have chosen to deal with it is unusual and maybe has very little, if any, precedent at all. I'm wondering if the big story here is the Chinese mission over time in this century to really marginalize Japan in East Asia, and that's kind of what this is all about. It's less about the islands and more about, those people over there in Japan, forget about them.
I think that certainly is one of the possible big narratives that's coming out of this. I was just in China until like 3 or 4 days ago, my latest trip, and the outright rancor towards Japan, both on the policy and the popular level, is really hard to convey, and also how much it's increased over the years. This is largely sort of manufactured by the Chinese government, but there's a really sour mood towards Japan, and so certainly there's almost an unconcealed intention on pushing the Japanese back from these disputed islands that the two countries call by different names. The question is whether in the longer term, this is part of some more expansive Chinese condominium than that, of wanting to establish the East China Sea as kind of their version of the Caribbean, what the Caribbean has meant for the United States. And there's a lot of debate about that, but this would count for the side of those who say there is, in fact, a strategically expansionist view underway on the Chinese side.
And if you look at the map, that involves Taiwan, that involves these islands in this chain, and it involves the Korean Peninsula as well.
It does. And if you extend the same approach a little further south into the South China Sea, as some Chinese sources have suggested, you have Indonesia, you have Malaysia, you have Vietnam, you have lots of other countries there. And also you have a extremely large proportion of the world's shipping traffic that goes through these goes through the South China Sea. It's coming from the big manufacturing centers of China, of South Korea, of Taiwan, of Japan, to markets in Europe and elsewhere. Some goes to North America, and energy supplies come back the other way. So if you had this dispute about the air and then sea lanes, especially in the South China Sea, you do have, again, a really congested situation. Mm-hmm. It would be like a European contest over the Mediterranean or the North Sea, where so many big countries are contending over so congested a space.
Finally, last minute here, I'm wondering, it's very important to China, and they've stated this explicitly, to be a leader in aviation, both in terms of manufacturing planes and in terms of enforcing muscle in the market by being the biggest flyers in the world. Do you think this is in some sense about their aviation industry as well as all these strategic concerns?
I think there's a nice kind of leitmotif connection for them, that they are have these ambitions in aerospace, and this is an aerial expansion too. In an outright contest of force, there's simply no comparison between the Chinese air resources and those of the U.S. and its allies now. But you're right, there's a kind of thematic wholeness to this move.
All right. China's declaring an air defense identification zone over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Commented there by James Fallows, national correspondent for Atlantic Magazine, who's reported on China extensively and just returned from there. James, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
One signature of the recession ending, according to economists and politicians, is the brisk pace of car sales. 14.5 million new vehicles sold last year, on a steady rise to the pre-recession 17 million annual figure. And October was the best month for car sales in the past 6 years. Part of that success story can be heard in commercials like these.
You know, life has its ups and downs, and things have been tough for most families the last 4 or 5 years.
Is your bad credit score causing innumerable problems in getting a car loan?
We can help reestablish your credit or get you in a new or pre-owned vehicle today.
If you want someone to ignore your bad credit score.
In a world filled with bad credit, with streets infested, with damaged cars, a new world is about to shine.
So, bad credit, no problem. How does that work exactly? And no problem for whom? Chris Kukla is the Senior Vice President at the Center for Responsible Lending. Hello, Chris. Nice to have you here.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So is there a bubble in the car loan business, and are there securitized car loans, just as there were securitized mortgage derivatives being sold and resold?
There are securitized car loans being sold, just like mortgages. And while I don't know that we have a bubble, I think we have some things that we really need to be concerned about. And here's why, is with subprime car loans, there is a practice that goes on actually with all car loans where the auto dealer can mark up your interest rate for compensation. So say you qualify for a rate of 5%, the car dealer may have discretion to mark your rate up to 7%. The concern that we have is that with research we did on loans that were securitized through subprime finance companies, so companies that sell, that make loans to subprime consumers, just by having that discretion and using it, the odds that that loan would end with the car being repossessed increased by 33%, which means that there are some significant risks in this marketplace.
And just the markup interest amounts to $25.8 billion over the life of some of these loans, right?
That's correct. For people who bought cars in 2009, they will pay $25.8 billion in additional interest for compensation to dealers.
What's the outstanding balance for auto loans in the U.S., if we can even assess that?
It's a moving number, but it is in the billions. And it is one of, you know, when you think about it, for most consumers, it is going to be the first or second most expensive purchase they make. The most expensive would be your home. But this is also something that folks need to get to work. And so it is a very important asset for families, and it's important that if we're going to do it, we need to do it right. We have some real concerns that the kinds of practices that go on in the auto finance market right now, especially in subprime, where you have consumers with much fewer options than those with prime credit, it increases the likelihood that they're going to be subject to a wide range of abuses in the auto lending market.
Third largest source of household debt, $783 billion outstanding auto loans. That's serious money. Any chance it would cascade through the economy like the housing market did if things were to explode?
You know, I think it's a little bit different because even though the scope of it is huge, the scope of the housing market was bigger. I do think, however, I mean, it can cause some serious economic dislocation because if you have families losing their cars, these are going to be families that then start having trouble keeping their jobs. And if you have a whole group of folks who suddenly find themselves unemployed because the car loan they got was unfair, that's going to cause some serious ripples in the economy, and certainly that local economy is going to suffer.
Chris Kukla, Senior Vice President at the Center for Responsible Lending, on problems in the subprime car loan industry. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This week, the team from Retro Report takes a documentary-style look back to 1992, when a brutal crime changed laws and sentencing in a way that has had enormous consequences in our time. Kimber Reynolds, the 18-year-old daughter of a Fresno wedding photographer, Mike Reynolds, was brutally killed in a robbery back in 1992. Kimber's murderer was a repeat offender, a career criminal who had just been released on parole. The crime prompted Mike Reynolds to begin lobbying for tougher laws against criminals with multiple offenses on their record. And what resulted was California's famous three strikes law, which became a model for mandatory sentencing nationwide. Karen Chigrou, Retro Report producer, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
How did this law specifically change the way judges and the criminal courts would deal with people who had, I guess, two strikes going into a trial?
This law made it mandatory that if you had a minimum of three felonies, that you would go to jail for 25 years to life. That took away quite a bit of the discretion on the part of judges to be more lenient or even tougher.
Now, there wasn't a lot of discretion as to what constituted a strike. Was it simply a felony?
In most states, the third strike, the third felony, had to be a serious or violent crime. After all, these laws were intended to hit violent criminals. In California, the fine print, which not everyone understood, was that it could be any felony. So even the lowliest crime could potentially send you away for three strikes.
And here's someone who experienced those consequences firsthand, Kenneth Keel.
I had became addicted to crack cocaine at about the age of 20, 21. I figured if I committed a petty crime, the most I could get would be a few months. I discovered that Gil Garcetti was the DA, and he was pursuing third strike cases similar to mine. And that's when I realized that this is serious business.
What happened to Kenneth Keel?
Kenneth Keel was picked up at a Kmart in Los Angeles for shoplifting $100 worth of goods. And because of his prior record, the district attorney, Gil Garcetti, at the time, decided to prosecute that shoplifting, normally a misdemeanor, as a felony. And that earned Kenneth Keel his third strike and 25 years to life.
This was a field day for prosecutors on some level. And as you've reported, some of these DAs and prosecutors have some regrets.
They do have regrets. You know, they were elected officials, so they were playing to the public fear of crime. They wanted to be seen as enforcers. But Garcetti, looking back, and this is one of the wonderful things about Retro Report, looking back, he is still reckoning with some of the decisions that he made.
The lesson learned from me is that I was the elected district attorney. I should have had the backbone to stick by what I said should be the law.
Perhaps the biggest consequences were, aside from defendants, for judges who had lost their discretion. Here's a judge.
It completely overreached and resulted in judges having to mete out sentences that were disproportionate to the criminal conduct. The three strikes law ended up populating our prisons, which are grossly overcrowded, with petty thieves and drug addicts.
That's Santa Clara County Judge Ladoris Cordell really talking about a huge population problem in California that's also extended nationwide. The result of three strikes?
Certainly, the three strikes law in California contributed to the overcrowding they're now facing, and a Supreme Court order to release 10,000 prisoners by the end of this year. Judges under three strikes lost a great deal of their discretion. And some of them actually, including Judge Cordell, refused to implement the law because she felt that the fallout was injustice more than any kind of fight on crime.
Is the pendulum swinging the other way now?
It could be. You have people like the Attorney General, Eric Holder, the governor of Texas agreeing on something, which is strange bedfellows, to say the least, that putting mass numbers of people in prison has broken a lot of state budgets. But also we've learned that prison, the longer you spend in prison, the better the criminal you are when you come out.
Looking back at the legacy from 1992 of California's three strikes criminal sentencing, mandatory sentencing law, Karen Chigrou, contributing producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So three strikes laws take discretion away from the courts and place defendants in categories that for some there is no escape. But there are other ways in which the government can place a black mark on the public or even not so public records of citizens. Take the U.S. terror watch list. It contains at the very least 700,000 people. The government doesn't reveal who they are or why they've been marked as potential threats, but being on such a list can have serious consequences. Joining us now to explain is Anya Bernstein, associated professor at the SUNY Buffalo Law School, author of the article The Hidden Costs of Terrorists' Watch Lists. Anya Bernstein, welcome.
Thanks.
So how do you get on a list? I mean, I think of false positives in drug tests, so you ate a poppy seed bagel or something like that. There are rational explanations, but if somebody told me they were on a watch list, I think I'd be inclined to be suspicious.
Well, you'd hope that that would be the case because we like to assume that our law enforcement agencies are doing a really good job. The unfortunate thing about the terrorist watch list situation is that we have no indication that they ever check the accuracy of their predictions. So they're making predictions about people's likelihood of engaging in terrorist acts, but there's no retrospective review. So you can get on a watch list by being suspicious to somebody, but you can't get off.
And is there any due process here? Is there any sort of FISA court that would determine whether you're on a list or supposed to be on a list? Is there a Freedom of Information Act challenge that you can make or even to disclose if you're on a list?
No. If you ask the government if you are on a list, they will tell you we can neither confirm nor deny your presence on a list. And they will do that all the way up through the federal courts. There's a case on the no-fly list that is at trial now, and the government refuses to disclose whether the person is on the no-fly list or not. There is no neutral arbiter determining whether you should be on the list. It's completely agency internal. It's all law enforcement.
And the list exploded. I think it peaked at over a million, and it was after the shoe bomber case in Christmas of, I believe, 2009. But what has happened to increase the size of the list? And does it really only apply to flying? I mean, if you're on a watch list, does it affect other aspects of your life other than when you want to get on an airliner?
Absolutely. The no-fly list is the most visible of the lists because you're prohibited from flying. So you have a pretty good idea that you're on that one. But there's actually tens of other subordinate lists that are collected by the Terrorism Screening Center, managed by various law enforcement and immigration agencies. And just to give you an idea of how bloated these things may be, in 2006, there were 71,000 names on the no-fly list. The Department of Justice criticized the Terrorist Screening Center for poor evaluation of its records. And within a year, the Terrorist Screening Center had cut that down from 71,000 to 34,000. So they themselves decided that half those people shouldn't be on that list.
But they wouldn't have done anything unless DOJ had asked them to.
Exactly. And that DOJ report was an Inspector General report, which are wonderful and often very thorough reports, but they're sporadic. And they pay attention to whatever they think they should be paying attention to. There's no regular review of the size of the list, the names on the list, or even the criteria by which the lists are compiled.
And there's no way a plaintiff could compel this or a class action lawsuit could compel this. It really was only DOJ that made this change.
Correct. If you try to challenge your inclusion in the list, basically the agencies involved have exempted themselves from all the statutory requirements to give you information about whether you're on the list and to allow you to contest that information. They've even exempted themselves from the statutory requirement that the information be accurate and that it be relevant to some government purpose.
Now, if you're a prosecutor and you go before a grand jury looking to indict somebody for suspicious behavior related to some terrorist investigation, if you say they're on a watch list, does anyone challenge that? Does anybody go, oh, well, that means nothing? Or, well, what kind of watch list? Or is just being on a watch list another strike against you?
Well, at this point, I think people just don't have enough information about how these watch lists are compiled to have a basis for challenge. All you know is that the person is on a watch list. So, for instance, there's a case a few years ago where somebody was arrested and he was on a watch list. And the judge, he challenged his arrest, and the judge said, well, being on the watch list in itself is not reason for arrest, but it's fine if that is part of the probable cause inquiry that the police officer makes. The police officer is allowed to take that into account as part of everything he knows about the person. So yeah, it counts as a strike against you, and the people enforcing the watch list don't have any way to challenge the accuracy of the listing or the criteria to begin with.
Is there any way to assess what population, what groups of people are disproportionately affected by these kinds of watch lists in the course of their day-to-day lives or their travels?
Well, we don't have any broad information about that, but every once in a while, something leaks out. So, for instance, a few years ago in Denver, the police compiled lists of people involved in various political activities, and that list made its way to one of the terrorism lists run by the FBI. And that included people like members of the National Rifle Association and Quaker peace activists.
So if you're someone who's declared bankruptcy and maybe defaulted on, you know, $50,000 worth of loans or even a mortgage, it's easier to restore your credit rating than it is to get yourself off a government watch list, based on what you're telling me, it seems like.
Well, absolutely. At least you know that you've been bankrupt and you know that you've defaulted. In the terrorist watch list case, you don't even know you're there. How can you clear your name?
And there's no process for doing so, or does DOJ want eventually there to be some kind of process?
The only process there is now is for the no-fly list to ask the agency to review their information on you. There's no process for challenging inclusion on the no-fly list, and there's absolutely no process for any of the subordinate lists that the Terrorism Screening Center maintains.
Anya Bernstein is associate professor at the SUNY Buffalo Law School and author of the article, The Hidden Costs of Terrorist Watch Lists. They don't sound so hidden after that conversation. Anya, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The so-called Arab Spring, as time goes on, looks more and more like the continued legacy of instability and violence left over from the colonial exploitation of Africa and the Middle East for centuries. A case can be made that the civil wars in Syria, the violence in Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia are less a flowering of democracy and more the product of corrupt governance and an outraged, inflamed citizenry, and that there's nothing particularly Arab about any of this. From Sudan and Somalia to Mali and Niger, all the way to West Africa, coups and sectarian struggles keep populations in poverty and militias at war. The Central African Republic, once called the Central African Empire under a particularly corrupt leader, is collapsing once again into violence. Rebels held by the country's transitional leader, Michel Djotodja, marched on the capital and ousted President Francois Bozizé. Now, the former French colonial masters are coming to the rescue. Hannah McNeish just got back from the Central African Republic. She's a freelance reporter. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you.
Where do things stand right now on the streets in terms of this coup and whether the government can actually control things?
I mean, on the streets of the capital, Bangui, you've got machine gun mounted pickup trucks with guys with turbans screeching down the road, forcing everyone to stop to a halt because they're so terrified of them. You've got guns everywhere. You've got French troops patrolling around the capital city with enormous machine guns, regional troops. It looks like the scene of a battle, but actually it's a crumbling colonial city with nice French restaurants. Up in the north of the country, you've got tens of thousands of people squatting in a Catholic mission and a couple of thousand people squatting in a church, hiding from each other, Muslims and Christians separated, hiding because there's been so much violence that's really turned into a sectarian conflict through political manipulation. It's a feeling of absolute anarchy and lawlessness, and that anything could happen to you whilst walking along the streets.
Hannah, what is the estimate of the number of people who have been displaced in the Central African Republic, and how many troops have the French military pledged to possibly keep order?
There are so far about 400,000 people who have said to have fled their homes. That's 10% of the population. But there are also half the population that's said to be in need. And UN humanitarian chiefs have actually said that all of Central African Republic's 4.6 million people are affected by this crisis. The French have pledged 1,000 more troops to the Central African Republic to bolster a force of about 400 that were there already. There's also some regional peacekeepers, but they lack the guns and the cars to take these guys on. So now I think that countries like France are desperately scrambling to try and rectify this situation, but realizing that they can't really do it on their own, and that at the Security Council there's interest in this, but to send in a proper UN peacekeeping mission would take about 6 to 9 months, whereas CAR is currently on the brink of what some people say genocide, what some people say is an enormous a humanitarian catastrophe, basically.
Hannah McNeish, freelance reporter, just back from the Central African Republic. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
So, the immediate cause of the crisis in the Central African Republic, a Muslim government trying to impose its will on an 80% Christian nation. Is the CAR some kind of special case of sectarianism, or does it add to the overall tragic legacy of France's former colonies since independence? Author and expert on the Muslim world and France's former colonies is Samuel Laurent. Samuel, welcome.
Welcome, John, and thank you for receiving me.
Do you think the chaos in the CAR is a special case, or are we seeing really a trend in this century of instability in a number of the French colonies, including Syria?
Well, obviously, you know, this country is, as you say, the legacy from the French colony in which the borders have been drawn in a very arbitrary way. But actually, this trend is accelerating for mainly one reason, which is the spread of radical Islam in the Sahel region. And this precise phenomenon, the spread of radical Islam, has been ignited by the first French intervention 2.5 years ago in Libya. By putting this country in a total chaos, we have driven a lot of weapons in the rest of the Sahel region. And this is probably the reason why such a minority groups in Central Africa has been able to act so decisively and to seize power over such a large majority of Christians.
This is a circumstance which the French have dealt with really back to the independence in Algeria. And I'm wondering if the aggressive moves by President François Hollande to really confront this is a sign of lessons learned and expertise that the French have developed here, or a sense of panic?
It's actually a sense of panic. The problem is that we keep the old instinct. As you know, this Western African region has been what we call the backyard of France. We even have a word for that, which is France-Afrique. That means French Africa in only one sole word. So basically, we consider this place like a place in which we have duties. But we do not understand that the whole region is currently undergoing very profound change.
Is there a movement within France to just walk away from these former duties, as you describe them, these former colonies? Or are we getting close to the point where someone's going to have to say occupation in terms of the Central African Republic to keep order?
Actually, it's extremely troublesome. You're right, John, because French, at least in terms of the political leaders, either on the right or on the left, are most united to say that those kind of very intrusive attitude are quite legitimate. This was the case in Libya. This was the case in Mali, which had a overwhelming support among the political class. And currently, there are very seldom major voice in the political spectrum that goes against the idea of an intervention in RCA, in Central Africa. But actually, if you look at what is Central Africa, this place is a mess. And despite the reassurance of our French defense minister, it is not easier than Mali. He's even himself telling that we have to recreate a state that does not exist anymore. And he's assigning himself a deadline of 6 months to do so. So I think it's more unrealistic, totally unrealistic. So we might be heading to a quagmire in which the French army will have to stay for long, and in which we're going to harm our own interests.
I wonder, Samuel Laurent, if the French government is going to find a lot of critics on the Security Council for this aggressive stance as France takes over the leadership of the Security Council in the UN.
Well, actually, you know, surprisingly, Africa is extremely positive about those operations. For many West African nations, for example, the remembrance of Mali, when the French have stopped the Islamist spreading towards the south, had a very positive impact on the image of France. But what people forget much too often is that this intervention in Mali is a direct cause of what we did in Libya. So therefore, I think, you know, Africa is pretty united for further interventions of France. And I do not think that the Security Council or other members of the United Nations will pretty much act against it, because obviously the situation on the ground is so bad and is so worrying for the people. We talk about genocide. Americans are talking about pre-genocide. But obviously, this is quite a popular operation. But in terms of strategy and politics, it is a disaster long term.
Well, a widening set of complexities and conflicts regionally in Africa among the former French colonies. Author and expert on the Muslim world and France's former colonies, Samuel Laurent, thanks so much from Paris.
Thank you very much, John.
So we want your voice in our program. Tell us a story. Tell us what you know at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.